Hi, and welcome to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Steve Martorano. Join us each week as we speak to experts in the behavioral health field, fostering diverse and meaningful conversation on substance abuse and mental health. Should come as no surprise that we're going to be talking about veterans on this edition of the program. We are smack dab in the middle of, I guess it's a Veterans Day weekend, the holiday, of course, on Monday the 11th. We're going to devote a couple of shows, I believe, this month on the issue of veterans and the problems they face in both the mental health field as well as substance abuse issues. A reminder again, the entire thing is sponsored by Retreat Behavioral Health, about which in a bit. So to that end, let me welcome to the program our guest, Andrew Henderson. Andrew joins us on telephone from his home in Florida. I will let Andrew go into the details of this, but he has a unique perspective on a couple of issues here, not least of which is his military career, which was, along with the rest of his life, derailed very, very seriously at a very young age when he ran head-on into substance abuse issues. Andrew will paint a picture of a pretty Norman Rockwell-ish kind of upbringing that would lead one to think, well, how could a guy like this wind up in the trouble he got in? But he came out the other side. Andrew is now celebrating over 2 years of sobriety, and we welcome him to the program. Andrew Henderson, thanks for joining us here on Recovery Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, man. It's really good to be on.
Did I get most of that right? I think I know a little bit about Lyme, Connecticut. I mean, Connecticut conjures up in everybody's mind, you know, as I said, a kind of Norman Rockwell existence to begin with. I know that's not true for everybody in New England or in Connecticut.
Right.
But tell us about you growing up there.
Well, my childhood in East Lyme was pretty, you know, white picket fence type esque, and you know, we had a great upbringing. I grew up in a small town on the Connecticut shoreline. I had the beach in my front yard, and I had, you know, 200 acres of woods in the back, and it was very normal. You know, I had a very normal childhood. I had two amazing, beautiful parents who are still, you know, a very big part of my life today. They've been married, you know, almost 30 years, and both parents that were, you know, I grew up in upper middle class, but you know, I went to public school and I played sports growing up, and I had a really I had a really fun childhood. You know, I didn't want or need for anything. I had two older stepbrothers who were major positive influences on my life. They were, one was the you know, town state policeman, the other was a you know, a decorated war hero who still serves in the military to this day. And you know, so that kind of, to paint a picture of the background that I came from, my father retired from the telephone company after 47 years of service as the union president there, and they met at the telephone company. You know, every aspect of New England culture was definitely brought into my life. And I'll say that at a very young age, I struggled with feeling a part of. And, you know, the kid that had friends, the kid that had sports and, you know, anything that he really needed to have, you know, I could easily walk into a room of people and feel the need to impress, you know, feel the need to one up. And it started from a young age. I'll never forget. You know, I had a real problem with being outspoken in all my classes, and also with lying, with being honest, you know. And when you're a little kid, you know, you tell like a little white lie here and there, and you know, everybody says, oh, you know, he's just young. And and gradually over time, you know, as I got older, as I became less and less more, you know, mature, all these kids were maturing and, you know, going to college and doing all these great things, and I always just felt stuck in my own way, and the lies got bigger. You know, the stealing came into the picture. You know, it started, you know, taking, you know, checks out of my father's checkbook, and then gradually, you know, the amounts of money turned larger as well. And I will say that I never really struggled with substance abuse until, later in my adult life. But I did struggle with addiction to other substances in my life, substances like money, substances like material possession. It came a point in my life where I sat down and I remember, telling you this, that there came a point in my life where I made a pact with myself, a very young Andrew, that I was going to do whatever it possibly took to be one of the quote unquote cool kids. And whether that meant drinking, stealing, lying, women, whatever the case was, I was going to do it. And that took a serious precedence in my life, I would say, in starting in high school. I was, like I said, an athlete, and everything kind of looked good on the outside. But when you really knew Andrew was, going through friends, different groups of friends every 3 to 6 months. He could blend in and really talk to anybody and everybody. He was stealing. He was lying. He wasn't a good person. And I found drinking, as an outlet, really, to kind of calm me down from all the baggage that I was carrying around day to day. And it worked, it started with a little bit of marijuana, started with a little bit of drinking, and it made me feel normal. It gave me that deep breath in, deep breath out type of feeling. And I finally got to a point where I was about 20 years old, and my father had came home from my freshman year of college, and I failed out, and I really had nowhere left to go. I was at a point where I was either going to go, work at the union for my father, where really he didn't even want me there, or go into the military like my two older brothers had. And I made the executive decision to join the military. And mind you, this was not a patriotic moment in my life. This was a moment based solely out of ego. Mm-hmm. I saw the uniform. I saw how people looked at my older brothers. I wanted that. There was no integrity base behind my decision. It was just, I'm going to go in the military. And I did. And I did very well. For the first 2 years of my military career, I succeeded, and I did very well. And then into my second year, this is around 2014. Again, I got very complacent and I got very un-okay with who I was and where I was, in a material sense. I saw other people succeeding, and they're getting married and, they had the house, the car, and I was still living at home with my parents, and I was working full time for the Army, and, the Army doesn't pay that well. So, you're not going to go into the military to get rich by any means. So I got very stagnant and very, very upset with myself, and I would just do, outlandish things to make up for that, whether it was, buying things I could never afford, or, having, multiple, talking to multiple women at one time, going out and getting inebriated to the point where I was blacked out. I found myself in that high school phase where I was just trying to do whatever I possibly could and ruining my life in the process of fitting in and being okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Andrew, let me stop you for a second. During this run up to the crash and burn, which I know you're getting to, was any of this behavior, were your folks or your stepbrothers or anyone aware that you were on this kind of self-destructive path, or were you high functioning and able to hide it from them?
Oh no. I mean, everybody knew, everybody knew. My parents didn't know what to do, and it talks about it in, I belong to a 12-step fellowship, and we talk about it all the time, is that, the alcoholic, the disease of addiction, one of the things that's so hard about treating the disease of addiction is that, there's no pill. You know, I can't, I would give anything in the world, you know, to be able to just take a pill and boom, be snapped out of my addiction, you know, but unfortunately it's a disease that I live with for the rest of my life. Now today I do have solutions to that and I do have a solution to my disease, but at the time, you know, this is 21 years old, you know, and, you know, they're just, sending me to psychiatrists and, you know, I mean, this all started from a very young age.
Oh, so you were getting psychological counseling all along?
Of course. Yeah. When I was younger, you know, and then when I got into my high school years, I was embarrassed. I was shamed at the fact that I had to go to a psychologist and take Adderall, and you know, it didn't fit into who I wanted to be, you know, and I didn't want the help. And during this time, I mean, you know, my depression was just getting worse and worse, and I was just out of control, lying and, you know, again, buying things and just, you know, nobody knew what to do. I was a contractor with the Department of Defense in Sikorsky, in Groton, Connecticut. And I had a really great job, and I left that job to go be a car salesman. And you know, I saw people that, you know, I was living at in the city at the time, and I saw people with the fancy cars and you know, the nice clothes, and I was like, wow, you know, I'd be a really good salesman.
Let me ask you at this point, and then I wanted you to continue that story into your military career and how this wrecked that. Mm-hmm. At that time, did anybody say to you that the substance abuse was not the issue? It was a symptom of the issue. You had very serious mental health issues that began when you were a youngster, right? Was anybody making that connection, or were they two separate things that were being treated?
It was two separate things. You know, alcoholism isn't profound in my family. You know, my grandfather died a dry alcoholic, but you know, there are spots and bits and pieces of alcoholism. But like I said, at this point, you know, in my story in the military, you know, substance abuse really wasn't an issue. It was more mental health, and I hadn't really resorted to using substances as a solution to, you know, the behaviors that was going on. And later on in my addiction and, you know, treating my addiction with the solution I have today, I was able to learn that, you know, my drinking was only but a symptom. And, you know, I touched a little bit on where my disease was going, in my military career. And, you know, I'll clarify that I was in the National Guard. So, you know, service duty was 1 weekend a month, and then 2 weeks out of the year I would travel for training. And when I was a contractor with the Department of Defense, you know, that was my full-time gig. I was a contractor essentially that wore a uniform. And so I really just had enough with life, and I said okay, you know, I'm gonna set out, I'm gonna be a car salesman, I'm gonna do the military 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks out of the year, you know, and I'll be fine. I'll make a ton of money. I'll still be in the military, and everything will be perfect. And, as you can imagine, that plan, did not go very well at all. Right. I'll never forget it. I was on a break. We had 2 months out of the year where we did not have drill, and it was summertime, and I was 23 at this point. And at this point, life had gotten really, really bad. I mean, really, really bad. And we were sitting around a fire one night, and somebody was passing around a joint. Mind you, I hadn't touched pot in probably 3 years prior to that. I was essentially sober from, you know, from marijuana and any, you know, dry substances for the time that I had been in the military. And I'd made a conscious decision at that split second, you know, when that joint was being passed around, I let go of the military. I knew I was going to get caught. I knew that, you know, my military career would be over. And incoherent to that idea. You know, that's how, that was where I was at in the grips of my addiction. You know, I just gave it up. I said, you know what? I don't need it. I need this though. So I, it got passed around. I put it to my lips and it was quite literally off to the races at that point.
At that moment, you realized that this was it. You were headed down this road.
Yeah. I distinctly remember that moment in my life where I just said, that's it. It's over, you know? And it was in that moment in time. And at that point, you know, you have to report that one weekend a month, for drill. And that following weekend, I didn't show up. I went AWOL. And in that same month, I remember, you know, I went AWOL and I made an excuse, and then the next month made another excuse. And, you know, and finally they said, you know, what the hell's going on? And behind the scenes, behind the lights, to paint a picture of what my life was like, you know, my family life was non-existent. My parents didn't know who I was or what I was doing or anything about me. At that point, I had no friends. I had no, you know, I was financially, struggling, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. And I was at a buddy's house. It was New Year's Eve. And I remember we were sitting on the couch, and it was, you know, wintertime in Connecticut. And there was a plate of cocaine. And I had that same thought, you know, and I remember he looked at me dead in the eyes. I'll never forget it. And he looked dead in my eyes. He said, you do that. He said, your life's going to be over. He said, don't do it. And I went over to the table and I did it. And in that moment in time, the best way I can explain it is it talks about in my fellowship, a white light experience. When I did that first line of cocaine, it was a white light experience that gave me it took away every emotion, every feeling, every lie, every bad point in my life that I'd hit. It took it away right then and there. It just took it away. And I chased that same feeling for the next 4 months, you know, you know, line after line, and you know, it just got worse and worse and worse progressively. You know, at this point I was, it was 2017. It was coming up to July of 2017. And my addiction, had gotten so bad, you know, that I was living in an apartment outside of the city in Middletown. You know, I was blacking out when I was drinking at this point. You know, the not being able to find your car, all that kind of stuff that goes into it. But, and I remember, just to paint the picture of the last 24 hours, it was dark. You know, my lights were shut off in my apartment. Mm-hmm. I had no money. I had no food. I had no friends. I had no family. It was just me and alone.
That white light, which suddenly turned very dark. Andrew Henderson has been sharing his story with us about substance abuse and the crash and burn that inevitably follows the disease of addiction and the mental health issues that very often underpin all that. Andrew, I want you to continue your story, but I wanted to pause it here in a second and point out this.
Absolutely.
The kind of irony here in your life. Here's a young guy, you say, at a very early age. Even before substances became an issue in your life, you raised in this middle class, upper middle class atmosphere, you immediately sought out kind of material gratification. It was important for you to have things that you thought were status symbols and jobs that would pay you money. You were very, as I said, materially driven, mm-hmm. which is not a bad thing. It's how people get successful. The problem is your behavior was counterproductive. Everything you were doing in pursuit of that dream was getting in your way. How aware were you during that period of time that you wanted certain things and then were doing everything to make it impossible. Were you aware of that?
You know, that's the thing about this disease is, you know, I suffer from a disease that tells me that I don't have a disease. And that's the issue, you know, and I learned that more and more in sobriety. But during this time, you know, I thought that, I was completely, you know, I was in full flight from reality. And that's the scariest part, you know, of an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Speaking for myself, you know, is that I wasn't aware. You know, my actions, were like a ripple effect. They, you know, every time I dropped a pebble in the water, it would affect, you know, multiple people. But I was only, you know, I was so self-centered and I was so selfish that I didn't see the effects I had on other people. You know, and I'd been brought back to the light many times, whether it was through, you know, I grew up going to church. I grew up, you know, doing various activities and therapy and all this stuff. But, you know, you can only lead a horse to water, you know, and I really do think, at least in my story, if it had not been for that bottom in that apartment that day, you know, where I had hit that emotional pit, you know, of self-pity. I wouldn't have gone on the road that I went, you know, have been going down for the past, you know, 2.5 years. And that really started, that was the jet fuel, into my journey of sobriety. I made a phone call that day to my father and, the retreat, that God works with, unions all over the country. And, my father, who had been in the union, you know, his entire life, I'd made a phone call to a guy named Jason, and Jason had gotten me brought to the retreat facility in Lancaster, PA.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just the jump start of my journey. You know, I'm not going to talk too much about treatment or anything like that, but I will say that it was the first time that I'd walked into a room and I got honest. It was the first time that I walked into a room and I learned about that I wasn't an abnormal person, right? But I did suffer from a disease that will eventually kill me. And it's no different than untreated cancer. It's no different than untreated diabetes. You know, over time, it will kill you.
Yeah.
You
know? Andrew, and let me ask you what the phone call to your father, those moments are as different as there are people who've suffered from this disease. That moment of sort of clarity when you realize this isn't working anymore, I need to do something about it. How did you articulate that to your father? Because after all, he'd seen bad behavior or you know, unhealthy mm-hmm. behavior for years. What did you say to him?
Well, you know, my parents had seen the self-destruction happening, and I said three simple words, and I'll never forget it. I just said, I need help. You know, and it was just like a conversation like you and I are having today. You know, I just called him and it was actually my mom that answered the phone. And I almost heard this like sigh of relief come over the phone. You know, it was like a sigh of relief. And I made an amends to my parents later on, you know, a couple of years down the road. And they said, you know, they had told me that they had gotten to a point literally where they had let go of me and put my life into God's hands. And I was either going to be dead. I was either going to be, you know, in jail or, you know, or whatever God had in store, you know, for me. They had accepted the fact that I was going to die. And I made that phone call to them and that's when they got me the help.
Well, it's, as I said, I say it all the time here, that these stories of substance abuse and recovery are all the same, except they're different. And yours sort of fits that pattern perfectly. When you get into a treatment, you get into retreats treatment facility, mm-hmm. and you say you know almost immediately that you're in the right place and you're going to make a go of this. Because, as you know, many, many people go to treatment many, many times.
Right. Yeah. And I just, you know, I was in treatment with people that had been there for the first time. I was in people that have been there for, you know, 30 times. You know, I saw both ends of the spectrum. And I remember sitting in group therapy with people that I could relate to and people that came from all different backgrounds of life. And like I said, you know, you explained it, the Norman Rockwell kind of picturesque in New England. But I was with, you know, heroin addicts that grew up without parents. I was with meth addicts that had been, you know, would sell themselves for drugs. And the funny thing is whether it was a heroin addict from Baltimore City or, you know, myself from a New England town in Connecticut, I could relate to those people identically. And that's when the disease clicked. That's when everything clicked. Like, you know, I have this disease. There is a solution, but I need to put in the action to get the solution to work. And I just surrendered. You know, I completely surrendered, and I stopped at that moment. I stopped telling myself that I know what's best for me. And, you know, the people at the retreat, the therapists, the clinicians, the psychiatrists there, you know, were giving me suggestions, and they were telling me about, you know, everything from medications that I should go on to, you know, to, aftercare. And, which was very critical, you know, because obviously, you know, I have this great feeling, 30 days of treatment, I'm good to go. But it's, you know, as you know, sobriety is so much more than just doing that. And, you know, so I had been referred to, you know, the retreat to stay at a halfway house in, South Florida. And that's how I ended up, down here. I stayed at a sober living facility through the retreat, continued, you know, about 6 months of therapy, and my life just changed. You know, I got involved with a 12-step fellowship, you know, in Del Rey. And Del Rey just happens to be the capital recovery community of the world.
Yeah, we know. I want to back up, I guess, back up a little bit and and discuss that in the midst of all this, your military service came apart along with the rest of your life. What were the circumstances of your discharge?
Well, I had a long way to go. You know, I had a long road of amends, I guess you could say, to go. I'd been given a general discharge under dishonorable conditions. And, you know, they tell you when you get out of treatment that you got to go work a humbling job, and I did. And, you know, I was working at a golf course, making $11 an hour cleaning golf clubs in the Florida sun. And, and I was happy, by the way. But I remember getting a phone call, and I'd been thinking about this amends for a long time, during my sobriety, because, you know, it was always a daunting thing putting it on a job application that I'd been, you know, dishonorably discharged with service or, you know, anything like that. And I really knew that I needed to do something about it, but what, I had no idea. And I'd been praying on it for, you know, for quite some time. And I was at work, and I got a phone call from a recruiter in New York. And if I knew the guy's name, I swear to God, I'd send him a fruit basket every month, because, you know, he really did change my life that day. But he called me and he said, "Hey, you know, we're supposed to check up on you." And I said, "Check up on me? You know, I'm no longer in the military." And he said, "Well," he said, "it's not a mistake." He said, "You're on our list for the enlisted ready reserve." And he said, "We're trying to recruit people to get back into the military, you know, that have been discharged." And I said, "Yeah, but, you know," and I told him my story, and I was very honest with him. And I told him you know, I was in recovery. And he came forward and he told me, he said, "Listen," he said, "if you do this," he said, "it'll wipe away the dishonorable discharge. You can go back to school." He's like, "You can get your life back together." And without hesitation, I immediately just said yes, you know, without even thinking, without a thought going through my mind, I said yes. And it was literally as easy as he sent me a piece of paper via email. I signed it, I got it back to him, and I was at drill the next month, the following month. And I was, you know, I was, 60 pounds overweight, you know, smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, and I, you know, I had no uniform, I had nothing, and I just showed up at this unit in Fort Lauderdale, And, you know, I'm sure everybody looked at me like, who the heck is this guy? You know, but it was really amazing. It was the first point in my recovery where I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm doing it.
Miraculously, someone calls you from a recruiting office and says, yeah, we know about the circumstances of your discharge under dishonorable circumstances, but it doesn't matter. You're on the list. We can give you a second chance. That happens for you. You embrace that second chance, and you're back now as a military man. What you were a specialist E4, is that right?
Yeah. So I came in. I was when I came back in for the second time, I was given this, you know, like you said, just an incredible opportunity. And when I came back in, I was a private still. I was a private when I was. You know, when I came out, I was discharged as an E3, a private first class. And so I came back in and, you know, I was out of weight. I looked like I'd been sitting on the DL for, you know, for a couple months in a situation like that. So I really had this monumental task ahead of me. You know, I really did. I had to figure out a way to be sober, be back in the military. And not only that, but comply with military standard, which meant passing a physical fitness test, being, you know, in weight, and showing up for drill and participating. And I had about a month to do it. And I remember showing up and I got all my information, got my new uniforms, all this stuff. And it was really great. But then I remember coming home and I was like, man, you know, we got a lot of work to do. And it took time, you know, it took time. You know, it took, I would say 4 months, you know, it was the summertime in Florida, 4 months of grueling, just getting into shape and running and, you know, quitting smoking and all this other stuff that goes along with it. But I came back to that drill, you know, and it was, I'd been going steadily for 4 months. And in the meantime, you know, I'd say that the most difficult part about being active military and in sobriety is balance, because, you know, you're required to show up, you know, and mental health in the military is not a benchmark. You know, it's not something the military takes a look at and says, okay, you know, that's important.
And I'm laughing because it's so obviously the case, and so obviously makes it even more difficult, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, because I go to the fellowship I'm in, I go to, you know, 4 or 5 meetings a week. I sponsor guys in the program. I have a full-time job. You know, I have a dog. I have a house. I have responsibilities outside of the military. And for somebody that lives a normal life, right, like you're not adding into account the excess of a 12-step fellowship into your life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you're going into a drill weekend, you better be mentally prepared, you know, because it's long, it's exhausting, it's, you know, it's hard. And so I came back after the first, like, 3 months of really gaining that balance. I came back. I went from 260 pounds to 200 pounds on the dot. I glared through a physical fitness test passing, and in the same weekend, I was given a promotion from private first class to specialist in the military.
Well, it's a remarkable turnaround, bookended by this military career, which is fascinating. The problems that veterans face are no different than anybody else in the society regarding mental health and substance abuse, but getting them help is more important than ever, which is why we wanted to hear your story and have you on this weekend before Veterans Day. I know you're in the, you know, this is 2.5 years or almost 2.5 years now of a complete turnaround. And again, congratulations about that. You are now in sort of the healthcare field. You recruit, well, tell us what you do as a recruiter.
Yeah, so along with my military career, which is going absolutely amazing, very successful in that, I also I work for a recruiting firm, and my job is solely to place, among, you know, other doctors and surgeons, MDs, I recruit the cream of the crop, the best psychologists in the nation, all 50 states, to work at various different facilities around the country. And, you know, I look for, you know, board certified, you know, fellowship doctors that, you know, work in addiction health and, you know, in places that, you know, to be quite frank, to places that where I was once, you know, treated for.
And are these people that you recruit specific or exclusively dealing with veterans, or do they treat anybody?
Some do, yeah. I mean, I deal with everybody from people that are just graduating from a fellowship to people that are, you know, medical directors of the VA. You know, it goes from all ends of the spectrum on the people I work with. And it's truly amazing, you know, to see my life, you know, you said it perfectly, come full circle. And, go ahead.
No. I was going to sort of sum this up. I know we could go on a lot, and your story is very, very encouraging, I'm sure, for a lot of people, both in the military and out. Andrew Henderson, thanks so much, and continued success with your life and your sobriety. We appreciate you joining us here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Recovery Radio, brought to you by Retreat Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one is in need of help, their admissions office is available 24/7 at 855-859-8808. That's 855-859-8808.